Hello and welcome back to the Historians Magazine podcast. My name is Chris. Museums are often one of the first places we interact with history. I know that was certainly the case for me. I grew up just outside the city of Bradford in the north of England. One of my fondest childhood memories was being taken to Leeds to the Royal Armouries Museum, a place I still happily visit today, often dragging my friends around as I constantly say, "Did you know?" or "Here's an interesting fact for you." Today I am joined by someone who certainly will have some interesting facts for us, Liz Penwill, an education assistant at the Royal Armouries. Liz, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come on the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm not doing too bad. How are you, Chris?
I'm not too bad. Yeah, not too bad. Looking forward to this. So we're here today to talk about a pretty special manuscript. What is it? And I guess, why is it so important?
Well, it's a very special object here at the Armouries. So special, actually. It's not currently on display. It's tucked away behind the scenes. It's got lots and lots of different names. So it's known as the Tower Fet Book, the Walpurgis Fet Book. Its sort of big official name is probably Royal Armouries MSI 33 or 133. It's usually just known as 133, which is its library mark. Shelf mark number. And the Fet Book is means combat manual in German. And one of the reasons it's so special, there are lots of different reasons why this is such a special object, is as far as we are aware, it is the oldest known European martial arts manual. So it's dated. There's been a lot of deliberation in terms of how old it actually is. At the moment, I know here what we are saying is we think it's from the early 14th century. So that's one of the reasons it's so special. It's so old, and it's certainly a really important object throughout its own history. We know that it's influenced a lot of other people's work, things that come after it as well. But the reason I find it really interesting is because of a particular person who appears in this manuscript. So we see three figures demonstrating a variety of stances throughout the manual. We have a priest, we have a scholar, and towards the end, the scholar is replaced with someone called Walpurgis. And the reason she is so special is, well, she's a she. We see a woman demonstrating sword and buckler on an equivalent level almost to a man. And that is something that we don't tend to see in other martial arts manuals, and that's why it's such a special and unique object.
Yeah, it certainly sounds kind of contrary to what we would associate with martial arts or combat or warfare in general. Do you think that is it rare that we see women represented in things like this, or are we just not looking hard enough for them?
I think it is rare. I think sort of throughout history, sort of any instance of a woman holding a sword, it really does seem to be a really sort of unique oddity. One of the other famous examples, the other well-known depiction, is in one of Hans Talhofer's manuscripts. It's mid-15th century, and it's a duel between a man and a woman. So there's a lot of differences between this and what we see with Walpurgis. So in Hans Talhofer, the man is fighting in a pit with a club, and the woman has a rock in a sling. It's shown as a duel. And what's essentially happening here is the reason the man's in a pit is it's trying to even the playing field. Men are so much better fighters that to make this a fair fight, this guy has to be in a pit for this woman to have any chance against him. Whereas with Walpurgis, she's sort of seen as an equal in terms of status. She's sort of definitely depicted in a really similar way to the scholar that's seen earlier in the text. So it's really rare that we see women in these sorts of manuscripts. I know sort of more generally, there's other images that clearly have been inspired by 133, when you see women in sort of similar stances and other sort of medieval depictions. And I think one of the things as well is certainly when you're sort of looking at the manuscripts is these are very rare and special objects in and of themselves. So that's one reason we don't have many depictions of them, is it's so rare anyway to find women doing these things. And because these objects on a whole are quite unique and special, we get even less sort of representation of women. In terms of 133 as well, we have two pages of Walpurgis. The manuscript, if you ever get to see it, you'll notice it is not in very good condition. It's had a long and interesting history. It was passed around an awful lot, and a lot of the people who it fell into the possession of make their mark on the manuscript. I know one person wrote his name on it. Some other people have scribbled all over it. There's a lot of graffiti in this manuscript. The pages are torn, and one of the things that we're pretty certain of is that there are pages missing, particularly towards the back. And so there might be pages and pages of pages that were in the manuscript when it was first made, showing Walpurgis doing her thing, or that might have been it. She might have just finished this sequence, and then we were back to the priest and the scholar. So we don't actually have that much of Walpurgis within this text. Obviously, the manuscripts, sometimes when people talk about it, she's the first thing people tend to know about this manuscript. I think in terms of Walpurgis as well, you've certainly got to ask questions about why she's fighting. Why is there a woman in this text? And we don't know who she is. There's lots of theories. Again, missing pages might have held the answers for us. So we know that she is called Walpurgis. One theory is that she might be one theory is that she might be a depiction of Saint Walpurga. So she was an 18th century missionary who travelled to Germany, which is obviously where the manuscript's from. If she's a saint, it certainly gives her more excuses to get away with doing different things. I know that some people that have looked at the manuscript think that they might be able to see a halo behind her. So she might be a saint. She might be a real person. If she is based on a real person, did this real person actually hold a sword? In terms of the person that obviously designed it, I know one of the things that we've done at the Armouries with the manuscript is we've brought the character of Walpurgis to life for school children, and I've worn a version of her dress. And the big thing you notice when wearing the costume, as she is wearing it, is it is actually quite practical to fight in. And for me, that really sort of stuck out when I was learning those routines is, on its own, this type of medieval garment isn't particularly practical to move in, as it's a lot of female clothing, but she's sort of got it tucked up into her skirt. It doesn't look particularly dainty. It doesn't feel particularly dainty when you're walking around in it with a sword and buckler, but what it is actually quite, I found, quite a practical way of fighting.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of answered my next question, which was, you know, who is Walpurgis? And I guess the chances are we may never know, but one thing I wanted to go back on is the fella fighting in the pit. I think you can interpret that as quite rightly as you say, you know, this obvious, you know, that men are far superior to women. Obviously, I'm being incredibly sarcastic there, but I think it means that it was happening enough that they had to have a system in place where, you know, a man and woman could fight on their term, on their version of kind of equal terms. So I think it's it must have been happening more than we kind of have proof of, because you don't write a manual about, you know, a kind of man fighting his wife potentially and having an entire system based on that if it hadn't happened at least once or twice before. So yeah, it's a great image. If people haven't seen that, it's definitely worth checking out, because it's at the very least it's quite a funny image. But something you mentioned already is bringing this manuscript to life for children. A very, very big part of my childhood, as I've already said, was visiting the armories as a kid, and I was very fortunate as part of a school trip was to go into one of the rooms, I'm sure it's still there, and, you know, put on a World War One helmet that had been shot through and stuff like that. So why do you think it's so important that we get kids hands-on with history?
I think it's just such a different way of learning, and it's fun. I'm of the horrible histories generation. That's the whole reason I did a history degree and got into what I do. And that's the highest compliment a child can ever give me, is this is just like horrible history. So a lot of the work that I do is character-based. Not all of it's character-based. A lot of it, but we always involve objects in our handling session. As you say, hands-on, letting children hold things. I mean, sort of one of the arguments when you're sort of talking about women and sword fighting is you go, well, if there's swords around, women are going to have picked them up. It's the same in the handling sessions. When you've got these objects out there, how can you not want to touch them? And the thing that I really find, the thing that moves me when delivering to the children is what we see in our sessions. When we're delivering in character, when we're letting them hold things and teaching them in a very practical way. So we teach them in one of our sessions some of the stances in 133, is children that maybe find classroom learning a little bit difficult thrive. They love it. And you can see it on their faces, and the teachers will tell us, so-and-so did really well, or I never expected to see this person do this. I've seen children that maybe struggle with confidence, struggle with talking to their peers, or maybe sort of have SEN needs, just have the time of their lives in the sessions. I think that's why certainly what I do is so important, because there's always the arguments with museums in terms of their places where you can learn about your history and your sort of heritage, and that is really, really important. But certainly for some children, some museums are a little bit difficult. Everything's a little bit out of reach for them to be able to see, or they might struggle with reading. Again, when you've got a handling session and all these wonderful objects that children can hold, it doesn't matter if they don't necessarily speak English particularly well, because you can put something in their hand and they sort of can learn history in just a very different, a very physical way. We always say what we like to do here at the Armouries is we like to bring history to life. And it's certainly one of those things where, for some children, certainly as you get older as well, in school, history becomes about how well you can write. None of our sessions expect the children to write. None of our sessions really rely on reading either. So it's purely just that sort of physical engagement that we sort of go for.
Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, like I said, I know this is an incredibly biased episode because I just adore the Royal Armouries, but it was a genuinely, you know, massive part of my childhood, because I'm fairly confident in saying now I still struggle to read to a level of, you know, a 29-year-old would probably expect, even though I'm sat with a full bookshelf behind me right now. So the idea that you can go as a kid and you can experience a topic that is very wordy, it's all dates and names and battles and people's names and everything, and get hands-on with it, it's huge. It's like I said, it stuck with me, so I'm sure it sticks with kids that do visit the museum today. And it's something that with the Little Historians magazine that we've also got running alongside the main magazine, that, you know, we really want to encourage as well. It's full of crafts and word searches and, you know, things to engage kids in different ways. So I think it's awesome. In case people listening haven't figured out already, I'm a huge fan. So yeah, if you haven't already, definitely visit the Royal Armouries when you can. So we've touched briefly on the manuscript that kind of forms the basis of the article that you've very kindly written for edition 13 of the Historians magazine. But I wanted to ask you, what is your personal favourite object or exhibit in the whole Royal Armouries?
It's a tricky one, because as you know, our collection is huge in terms of the things on display. Besides having a soft spot for the pulse rifle, as a massive alien fan, I know that was what initially jumped out to me when I first actually applied for this job. I was like, ooh, I've got the pulse rifle here. Probably since getting to know the collection a little bit more, on display, probably my favourite object that we have is called the Pioneer Helm. So it's one of six Anglo-Saxon helmets that have ever been found here. It's not as famous as things like Sutton Hoo or Coppergate obviously being probably the most sort of local one up here in Yorkshire, but the one that we have in our collections is the Pioneer Helm. And I think that's why I quite like it. It's a little bit underrated, it's my sort of personal take, but it's still such a important object. Again, the further back you go in history, the more scarce certain objects become. So to sort of put it into a bit of context for people, it's a Saxon helmet, very, very similar to the Coppergate helmet. So the helmet itself is about 90 years younger than the Coppergate helmet. It's been dated to the late 17th century, and it's found in Northamptonshire. In terms of the design, it's quite sort of simple, and it looks sort of quite basic. It doesn't sort of stick out as much as things like Sutton Hoo or Coppergate. It doesn't have all this gold all over it, but it has a little bore on top of it. So it's very, very similar shape to the Coppergate helmet with just a little bore on top. And in our handling collection, we have a replica of it, and the bore has some fur on top, which I just think is very, very cute. And it's in reasonably good condition. You can visibly see that it's a helmet. And we use it in our sessions, actually, to talk about Beowulf, which, again, is something that a lot of children do at school. It's a very convoluted story. Throughout the story, people are described as having boar-crested helms. And again, because it's such a complicated story, depending on what version you're reading, it might be quite difficult to follow. To be able to have an object and go, this is what these helmets might have looked like, this is a genuine object, is just great for the children. So that's what I spent my morning doing, actually, was being in the galleries and telling people about this particular helmet.
I mean, that sounds like a great morning to me. Any kind of tangible history, as we've made reference to a few times, is so important, isn't it? And great example with Beowulf being a very, very difficult to read story. If you can add some kind of tangible element to it, whether it's, you know, a helmet, or, you know, this is an Anglo-Saxon sword or whatever it is, it's much easier for, you know, for kids or adults to kind of get to grips with the history, because, you know, the whole point of the Historians Magazine and the work I do personally is to make history accessible. And that comes in, as I'm sure you'll agree, it comes in all kind of shapes and sizes, doesn't it? So yeah, that's a cool, and it is a very great, it's a great little artifact in the museum. Again, I like everything there, so I'm
yeah, I want to ask what your favorite object
is. I knew that was coming, and I don't have an answer. I really don't like Henry VIII. Anybody that knows me knows how much I despise Henry VIII. So, but the horned helmet is very cool, isn't it? Yeah. I think my favourite thing in the Royal Armouries is, I forget the name of it, it's the absolutely beautiful suit of armour. Is it the lion? It's got it's 16th century, I'm sure. I don't think it was ever worn. I think it was made for the Holy Roman Emperor, and it's like black and gold, and it's just really cool. And every time I go, I see it, and I'm always like, "That is the coolest." That is the point where we were like, "Yeah, we've really made the coolest suit of armor ever." But I guess the other one that I really like, which if my mum is listening, she'll laugh at this, but there is always a tiny little suit of armor, like a full plate suit of armor. And I'm only very small, so whenever I used to go as a kid, my mum used to always point at it and go, "Oh, look, Christopher, there's your suit of armour." So I have a bit of a soft spot for the tiny little suits of armour in there. But I also really want the Agincourt table in my living room. I just think it's the coolest coffee table potentially in the world. If people, again, haven't seen that, it's 100% worth seeing. But there are so many amazing things in the armories.
Yeah. But now you're talking, yeah. I'm like, oh, there's this, there's that, there's a little bit of something for everyone. I think it obviously has this big sort of appeal to people that are really into arms and armor, but in terms of the stories behind some of the objects as well, it's really interesting. So you've mentioned obviously the Agincourt table, the table that we have depicting Waterloo, the entire sort of story behind how this was put together from different people's accounts of the battle, and how it's sort of considered in and of itself as an object just really valuable for historians as well to look at, is so interesting. Because yes, you can go as a military historian and look at it and find interesting things, but just as anyone with a general interest in history and objects, there's all these other stories to tell with some of these objects as well.
Yeah, and I know obviously this is a kind of medieval themed podcast episode, but you know, the Royal Armouries isn't just medieval history, it's history through up until the present day, kind of told through arms and armour. So if you're listening to this going, "I absolutely hate medieval history," I don't know why you'd be listening this far in. But if you are, then don't worry, there is plenty to see at the armories. I, again, absolutely fully recommend a visit at some point. So always ask the same few questions at the end of all of these episodes. They're supposed to just be a bit of fun, but so far they've been my favourite questions that I've had. Favourite answers to questions that I've had from pretty much everyone I've spoke to so far. So I'm intrigued because you've already told me you're not a medievalist, and I told you I'm not going to hold it against you, but I'm now intrigued as to what your answer to this first one is, which is, if you could go back in time to any time, event, or anything like that, where would you go and why?
Well, it's funny you've sort of said that. Is actually I've gone a little bit prehistory with my answer. I really want to go back to Celtic Britain. Again, I think this has come from the fact for most of my week I'm an Iceni warrior and covered head to toe in blue paint. But be intrigued to go back to Celtic Britain. I think because from the sort of research that I've had to do for this workshop, there's so many things that we just don't know the answer to, particularly actually in terms of looking at gender, because obviously the few accounts that we have obviously from the conquest of, you know, the Romans coming over and what they said about everything, and even with that, in terms of trying to read what the Romans have said and decipher what people were actually like. Obviously, there's lots of questions in terms of did people at the time, obviously, when you say the word Celt, you think about blue paint. Was it paint? Was it, what did people obviously have tattoos? There's so many different questions. I think certainly for me as a woman and someone that's, as a historian, is really interested in gender and how the construction of gender changes over time. I would be curious to go back and actually see what the role of women was like in these prehistoric societies, because I think there are some things that as historians we can try our best to guess, but in terms of actually finding the actual answers, just to sort of be there and sort of witness it. I know that obviously when you sort of talk about people like Boudica, obviously we know she existed. Were there other people? Who else was there? And obviously the circumstances under which Boudica does end up leading a rebellion, essentially. It feels like it's an example of sort of exceptionalism. It's a woman doing something that traditionally women wouldn't have done. But, you know, even so, the way in which sort of gender operates in that society is going to be vastly different to what comes next under the Romans.
Yeah, again, that's another great answer. Like I said, I've not been disappointed yet in this series. And I think, as you mentioned, though, with Boudica and ideas around gender, it's definitely a topic that you see throughout history. As someone that is utterly obsessed with Eleanor of Aquitaine and the fact that we don't even know when she was born, and this is, my maths is terrible, what, how many? Like 1,200 years after, roughly after Boudica? And we still aren't great at writing down when women were born. It's a poor do, isn't it? And I think, yeah, if we could get the answers to questions like that, it would fundamentally change our understanding of not just history, but like you said, of gender as well, which, you know, would be great to kind of figure things out. Awesome. So I've asked you one half of the question. The other half is, if you could bring one person from history through to 2023, who would you bring and what would you show them? Why are you bringing them through?
I've gone much, much, much more recent with this answer. I'm also going for someone who I don't expect anyone to have actually heard of, but it's someone I've done a fair bit of research in terms of my personal interests as a historian. I'm very into my sort of cultural history and again, sort of exploring the lens of gender. And so the person that I've picked out is someone called Cecil Spooner. So she was an American actress, writer, director, sort of did a little bit of everything at the start of the 20th century. She's one of a very few people that actually had a really successful career, both on stage and on screen. Many people didn't manage to make that jump when we start to see films being introduced. And throughout her career, she plays boy roles. And I always sort of consider these as there's sort of three different types of role that women in this period are assuming when it comes to sort of playing boyish characters. There's literally playing boys, and I'd use the word boys rather than men because it's usually children. Female characters who are tomboys, and then women who, for whatever reason, have to disguise themselves as plays. And Cecil, she was a very, very talented fencer. And one of her plays that was really successful, it was called Sword of the King. Her character has to disguise herself as a man and ends up doing some fencing. And the reviews basically state that they loved it. It went down incredibly well. I think the next play that she was in, they basically just made it about her demonstrating her fencing. There's not really much plot going on. She isn't in this particular play disguising herself, her character, or actually playing a boy. She is this character that's a dancer who also can fence. And I think these sorts of figures, they really interest me because these female performers, or people who are certainly at least assigned female, essentially perform what we'd probably consider drag, or at least present themselves in a much more masculine way as a way of being able to explore traditionally male pursuits. Once Cecil establishes herself as a talented fencer, only then is she presenting as a female fencer on the stage. And there's loads of other examples of this. I can remember reading something to do with female comedians in one state in the US. That was banned late 19th century. And so to get around it, women would say they were male impersonators. Whether that would mean they would dress in male garb or not is another question. But that was how they had to get around being able to perform comedy. And so, yeah, bringing it back to Cecil, I said she was just someone that just really stuck out to me. Again, as a comparison to Walpurgis, you're looking at a woman who is a very talented sword fighter in terms of the way in which she's depicted. I'd love to bring her into the 20th century to show her how much has changed and how much actually hasn't changed. Certainly, it's a lot easier today for women to get into things like sword fighting or sort of other comparable, you know, more, I guess, masculine sports. But even in terms of sort of sport and activity in general, there's a real hesitation among women to take things up, or you don't just see as many people. I know here at the Armouries, you know, we're really keen to be able to put on more shows with more women at the forefront, but there's so many sort of hurdles to that, and still a little bit of a stigma, and it's changing. And I think the reason I'd like to bring Cecil here is because I think she'd love it. She'd be glad that she could join in with the sword fighting. But then there's still things that are the same in her time that there are today, essentially.
I wonder what she'd make to an episode of RuPaul's Drag Race. I think I'm assuming she'd probably love it. But yeah, again, it's I've never been disappointed with anybody's answers for these, because they're always so varied, and everybody has their reasons why. But it always kind of comes back to, like you said, about showing what has changed, but also what hasn't. And we're fundamentally, for better or for worse, the same as we've always been. I think sometimes we see ourselves looking back on history as this incredibly, you know, well-versed human being that's been through the worst of everything, when really we're still just kind of figuring everything out. And it's sometimes it's a good thing, and other times it isn't, but we keep learning, don't we? So I think those are two great answers, like I said. But I'd love to give you the opportunity now to share any social media handles, any projects that you've got coming up. Obviously, we've already alluded to one, which is based around the manuscript. I cannot say the full name of, so I'm just going to keep calling it the manuscript and let you do that. But yeah, you've got the floor for as long as you want. You can plug whatever you want, whether it's personal, whether it's the Armouries, just go for it.
Wonderful. So I don't really have any personal stuff of my own. But in terms of the armories, we've got lots of things going on. So I'm a member of the education team. We work with schools. So if you've obviously listened to what we've been talking about, reasonably local to Leeds and thinking, hey, my pupils would absolutely love that, do get in touch. Details about all of our workshops are on the Royal Armouries website. Worth mentioning, when we're spelling armouries here, it's with an O-U. It's not just an O. So if you're interested, obviously, in booking a workshop, do get in touch. We are currently getting ready to take bookings for the next academic year. I think at the moment, in terms of our special projects that we are doing around the manuscript, Mightier Than the Sword, that is something that we do for a really select group of schools here in Leeds. And I think we are fully booked for that. But that's one of our projects that we've got. In terms of the museum more broadly, we're open Tuesdays to Sundays every week. Every day we have different shows on from our live interpretation team. So some of these are combat demonstrations, some of these are talks, performance pieces. When it comes to school holidays, we're open every day in school holidays, including bank holidays as well. As I said, we always have shows on. In terms of events that we have coming up here, so we're doing a couple of little bits and bobs for the coronation weekend. So we'll be open Saturday, Sunday and Monday with a range of activities based around the coronation. I believe on the Saturday we are having our own parade as well at some point. So that's one of our next things on our calendar coming up. And I know as well, I wrote down the name of this because I was checking with people earlier, so I made sure I said the right thing. So when it comes to the next half term here in Leeds, Tales of the Old West is the theme. And so hopefully we'll have some talks to do with things like cowboys and all sorts of stuff like that. So that's what we've got coming up here. In terms of socials, I did make sure to check our social handles as well. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. On Twitter, we're Royal_Armouries. And on Instagram, we are Royal Armouries Museum, one word. So that's where you can find us as well to find out those things.
Amazing. Thank you so much for that. And if there are any teachers or, you know, pupils, I guess, listening to this, trust me, they're worth going to, because I guess you might end up hosting a history podcast when you're a bit older, because I'm living, you know, walking proof that they are at the very least entertaining, if not educational. Yeah, that pretty much wraps up for today quite nicely. For those that want to read more about the Royal Armouries and specifically the Mightier Than the Sword project, you absolutely must, as always, check out edition 13 of the Historians magazine, and make sure to sign up to our newsletter to keep up to date with everything history from around the UK and beyond. Liz, thanks again for taking time out of your day. I've thoroughly enjoyed that chat. So yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
No worries. And thank you everybody for listening.